From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, a two-part cover story. Part one, what's killing King Coal?
Natural gas is going to kill more coal-fired power plants than the EPA regulations.
Natural gas now accounts for a third of all electricity in the U.S., and some people believe it could actually save the planet.
The U.S. will decrease greenhouse gas emissions by something up to 40%.
But there are pitfalls as well. And later, the explosive legal standoff that could link Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams to an unsolved murder from 1972.
He was the Belfast commander at the time, so the buck stopped on his desk, as they say.
Also, vacationing in sunny Chernobyl, the movie Mira Sorvino could watch a million times. And later, Batman is Back. Director Christopher Nolan opens up about The Dark Knight.
He doesn't have superpowers. Base level, he's just a guy who likes to do a lot of push-ups.
And also, how chia pets could help you live longer, and why 80s rockers Def Leppard have become a Def Leppard cover band. That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. At some point today, you'll probably flip on a light switch. I'll do it right now. Now, that simple act, flipping that light switch, it connects you to the oldest and most plentiful source of American electricity. Since the early 1880s, when Edison and Tesla pioneered the distribution of electrical power into our homes, most of that power has come from the process of burning coal. But something started to change about 4 years ago. First, it was slow, and then, this past month, that change became dramatic. Just 4 years ago, coal was still king. In that light switch or your blender or your TV set, coal powered half of it. But today, coal's share of U.S. electricity is down to a third, and it's falling. Today and tomorrow on the program, we're going to take a closer look at what's killing King Coal and what that might mean for the economy and the environment. Our story begins smack in the middle of West Virginia, Webster County, population 9,000. Webster Springs is the county seat here. It's a small town built around an historic courthouse. Right in front, the symbol of what built this county, a huge slab of shiny black coal. We came to Webster County because last month, Arch Coal, the operator of one of the biggest mines here, announced a round of devastating layoffs. One of our stops was at the office of Webster County's newspaper, The Echo, where we met up with Thomas Clark, the publisher and a mine inspector for the past four decades.
Well, I think in the last 6 months, it's just been a landslide.
In the past few months, Arch Coal has announced more than 1,300 layoffs in West Virginia and Kentucky alone. Between the other big players in Central Appalachia, Consol, Patriot, Alpha, thousands more have been lost. And this past week, Patriot filed for bankruptcy protection.
I mean, I've never seen anything as quick as this to devastate the market and this many layoffs at one time. This thing just, bam, it was here.
A few miles from Webster Springs, outside the town of Cowan, West Virginia, stands a massive steel hopper. It is now silent, almost like an abandoned roller coaster. Just a few weeks ago, this hopper was humming. It was humming with the sound of thousands of tons of black coal coming down from the Eastern Complex mine right on top of the mountain above.
For 17 years, it was work all you want to work. I mean, you're looking at one here, I work 7 days a week. I work Sundays. Overtime, more the merrier.
For almost two decades, Rich Lewis worked as a miner on this mountain.
We was shipping anywhere from 30 to 34, 35 trains a month. Well, in the last year and a half, it went down to probably 20 trains a month.
But today, there are no trains to collect the coal, and they won't be coming back here ever. A few weeks ago, Arch Coal gathered all 170 employees of this mine to make a grave announcement.
Our superintendent told us that right now, the coal that we're selling, they was getting $56 a ton. With all the equipment we're running up there, it's costing $70 to mine it.
Everyone, including Rich Lewis, would be laid off. And today, of the three mines in Webster County, just one is still operating.
Turn some lights on.
Should we take our shoes off?
No, you're fine.
About 3 miles down the road from the Eastern Complex mine, 37-year-old Todd Bragg shows us around his house. Out back, his kids are playing basketball. Todd Bragg started mining at age 19, and he's known Rich Lewis since they were kids in grade school. Coal has been very good to them. The median family income in Webster County is $25,000. Up until a few weeks ago, before he was laid off by Arch Coal, Todd Bragg was pulling in more than twice that amount.
It helped me survive. Paid for these, my family, everything.
So it's been it was a pretty good job.
Oh, yeah.
When we met up with Todd a few weeks ago, the announcement was still sinking in.
It's a shock to everybody. I mean, it's, what are we going to do? You know, and you ask your friend, what are you going to do? Me and Rich was talking today, what are you going to do? I mean, it's just, it's up in the air.
But still, Todd and Rich are grateful. Arch Coal gave them 2 months severance and will cover their health insurance until Thanksgiving. If you're looking for the best biscuits in Webster County and some good local intel, head over to the Hilltop Diner in Cowan. The regular breakfast crew is here, downing mugs of strong coffee and lapping up plates of thick bacon and homemade potatoes. Ask any of them the reason for Coal's precipitous decline here. The answer is unequivocal.
President Obama's a lot of the problem because he's against coal. He wants to shut down all coal-powered power plants, and they'll eventually get it done. EPA is the big problem around here.
Back in March, the EPA announced standards that require all new coal-fired electricity plants to cut carbon emissions by half. It's an expensive proposition, and it's leading many power companies to back away from coal. But to get to the heart of what's really killing coal, you have to travel south from Webster County, about 500 miles, to Atlanta, Georgia. This is one of Georgia Power Company's newest plants in metro Atlanta.
Output of two gas turbines and one steam turbine.
The plant manager, Tony Tremonti, is duly proud of it.
840 megawatts. That's enough energy to supply about 250,000 homes.
Railroad tracks used to lead right up to this facility. Every 2 days, a 100-car train would pull up filled with coal.
And we consumed about 5,000 tons of coal a day.
Today, those railroad tracks are gone, dismantled. The old coal turbines, mothballed. Georgia Power, like a growing number of power companies, is ditching coal and switching to natural gas. Tony Tremonti explains one reason why.
Overall, the air quality improvement is dramatic. There's a 100% reduction in mercury emissions, a 50% reduction in the rate of carbon dioxide production, a 99% reduction in sulfur dioxide, and about a 90% reduction in nitrous oxides, with a plant that's now five times larger than the one it replaces.
The bigger reason, though, is simpler. Money. 4 years ago, electricity generated by gas was twice as expensive as coal. Today, gas is less than half the price of coal.
And what that means is literally, natural gas is going to kill more coal-fired power plants than the EPA regulations.
That's Michael Zenker, a coal analyst for Barclays. In 2012, he explains, a perfect storm of sorts took place that sent coal down a deep spiral. And unseasonably warm weather, for starters, also a significant reduction in electricity demand because of the economy, and most importantly, technological advances that have brought cheap and abundant natural gas. Much of this is due to hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. That's a controversial process by which gas can be extracted by drilling deep into rock formations. A decade ago, no American gas was produced this way. Today, about a third of all our gas is now the product of fracking. And last month, for the first time in U.S. history, natural gas generated as much electricity as coal.
We could see coal down at 15 or 20% of electric supply over the next decade. That would be a huge change in an industry that historically has relied on coal for 50% or more of the total electric supply.
That's David Victor, a fossil fuel expert at UC San Diego. Think about this for a moment. In 1988, coal generated almost 60% of America's electricity. Today, it's hovering at around half the amount, the lowest since the government started recording that statistic. Now, there have been times when coal's demise has been prematurely predicted, notably in the 1980s. But the U.S. is still a coal powerhouse, often called the Saudi Arabia of coal. This time, though, says David Victor, it's different.
We were talking about the death of coal in the 80s, but coal was half of the electric power supply and didn't change very much. Now we're talking about maybe not death, but terminal illness for coal in the advanced industrialized countries, and it's actually happening.
As for places like Webster County, the consequences are real. Todd Bragg and Rich Lewis, who we met earlier in the story, are considering taking jobs at a mine in Grafton, West Virginia, about 100 miles away. The owners of that mine say it'll produce coal for the next 30 years. But with higher costs and declining revenue, that promise is a big question mark. But either way, for Todd Bragg, it could mean the difference between unemployment and a few more years of security.
That'll be close to retirement age.
Yeah,
if it lasts.
Right.
With the gas the way it is now, you don't know what's going to happen.
The other consequence of the natural gas boom is an unintended one. As UCSD's David Victor points out, since 2006, the amount of carbon emissions the U.S. produces has fallen by almost 8%, the most significant carbon reduction in the world.
You put all that together, and the shift from coal to natural gas has reduced U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide by 400 to 500 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. And to put that number in perspective, that number is on the order of twice the total effect of the Kyoto Protocol in the rest of the world.
David Victor says this is still not enough to slow down climate change, and with fracking comes other environmental problems. Tomorrow on the program, we'll explore that side of the natural gas revolution in more depth.
We need to watch out for the environmental side effects of the gas revolution. There have been some wells that have led to small earthquakes, local water pollution. There are air pollution concerns associated with fracking as well, and so we need to find ways to address those.
This past week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, released a report linking climate change to some of the extreme weather events of 2011, things like the devastating drought in Texas and record-high temperatures in Britain. Now, none of this bodes well for the future, but there is a possible glimmer of hope. It turns out that U.S. carbon emissions are down nearly 8% since 2006. Now, much of that has to do with a weak economy. People are consuming less electricity. But another part could be related to the decline of coal and the rise of cleaner-burning natural gas. Yesterday on the program, we heard about how natural gas is killing the Appalachian coal industry. Today, for our cover story, we're going to take a closer look at its impact on the environment, both the good and the bad.
The shift from coal to natural gas has reduced U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide by 400 to 500 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. And to put that number in perspective, that number is on the order of twice the total effect of the Kyoto Protocol in the rest of the world.
That's UC San Diego professor David Victor. He's an expert on the politics of fossil fuels. We'll hear more from him in a moment, but first to that NOAA report we just mentioned. Philip Moat was one of its authors. He's the director of climate change research at Oregon State University. He and a team looked at last year's drought in Texas, and they compared what happened there with climate models going back five decades. And they wanted to figure out the odds that the drought was indeed related to climate change.
It was so far beyond anything that had happened before. It was so much warmer a summer than the next warmest summer, and so much drier. It really was a very extreme event.
Should we expect more extreme weather events in the coming years?
Well, I think that's a question that science is still answering, but certain types of extreme weather events, it's pretty clear, are increasing and will increase as the climate changes. Extreme heat events being one. In some places, extreme rainfall events. Extreme cold events, there's very little reason to believe those will get more common. One incorrect conclusion is that global warming is not happening. Another incorrect conclusion is that global warming is making our weather more extreme in every respect. The correct conclusion is probably that that cold event happened despite global warming.
What ultimately do you think this report by NOAA that you were a part of, what should we get out of it? I mean, do you want readers to say, well, we need to be prepared for this, or we need to begin to seriously think about carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions? What's the hope behind it?
Well, I think for the scientists involved, the primary interest really is, can we understand what's happening in the world around us? That's always the motivation of science. In this case, we're talking about events that are part of a larger landscape of how we're changing the climate. There are certainly preparedness issues. Even without climate change, in some respects, the ever-growing human race is very unprepared for extreme events. But we should certainly be prepared for those events that we now think are extremely unlikely, and they're actually getting much more likely.
That's Philip Moe, one of the authors of the new report by NOAA linking climate change to extreme weather events. The question now is whether human behavior can halt the pace of climate change. President Obama has set a goal of reducing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 17% by the end of the decade. And a new study suggests that goal may actually be feasible, not because of tough new regulations or legislation, but rather because of the increasing use of natural gas to generate electricity. Gas is now one of the cheapest sources of electricity generation, half the price of coal. Much of this is a recent development, the result of advances in hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, the controversial process by which gas is extracted from deep under rock formations. Fracking now produces a third of all U.S. natural gas. Lawrence Cathols, a professor at Cornell University who wrote that study, took a close look at natural gas usage, and he found that replacing coal with natural gas would cut about 40% of carbon emissions linked to global warming.
When you burn natural gas, it's a cleaner burning fuel. It combusts in part to water rather than just CO2. And so there's intrinsically 30 or 40% less CO2 produced when you just burn natural gas as opposed to, say, for example, coal. But the more significant thing for natural gas, if you use it for electricity generation, is natural gas can generate electricity with almost twice the efficiency in terms of conversion of the energy content of the fuel that you actually get converted to electricity. You convert twice as much as you do with coal, more or less.
Now, natural gas is made up largely of methane. That is a greenhouse gas. Doesn't fracking, hydraulic fracturing, doesn't the process, you know, by which natural gas is extracted from the earth, doesn't that lead to leaks and higher emissions?
I don't think so, no. Natural gas in areas where you're burying organic material is leaking out all over the place. It's more or less ubiquitous in areas where you're burying carbon. We're burying carbon all the time anyway as we bury plant material and whatnot.
How is it that it wouldn't leak into the atmosphere when you fracture these rocks and you extract this gas? It would seem self-evident that it would.
Some does. And the question is how much. And the numbers for the leakage of gas from the well site to the customer through the pipes and compressors and so on and so forth, is about 1.5% of the total production of the gas. So we are losing a bit of gas in bringing it to the customer, but it's not significant from a climate point of view.
You argue even with that methane that's released into the atmosphere, if natural gas replaces coal, U.S. carbon emissions will be reduced by 40%.
In the short term, in the period over which you make this transition, if the leakage is about 1.5% or 2% or even 3%, which I think is way too high, the U.S. will decrease its greenhouse gas emissions by, you know, something up to 40%, depending upon exactly how much leakage there is.
The argument you often hear is, well, coal is bad for the air and the atmosphere, mm-hmm. but natural gas, fracking, is a disaster for water supplies.
No, I don't think so there either. I think what's happening is people don't like the idea of natural gas being tapped in their backyard, and there's methane in water in a lot of these areas today. I'm quite sure I could have lit my faucet on fire, and this is where I live. We moved out of that house.
This is in upstate New York we're talking about.
It's in upstate New York, yeah.
And, but why would you want to drink that water?
Methane, you can't smell, you can't taste, you really don't even know it's there. It's not harmful to you unless you, you know, in a shower accumulate enough of it that it becomes an explosion hazard.
But is it worth it? Is that risk, in your view, worth it? I mean, essentially what you're saying is there is evidence to suggest that fracking can damage water
I don't think there is. No, I disagree with that. Hmm. I think that the risk from a methane escape point of view is in the shallow part of the drilling before you've got the casing in place properly. And the risk is tapping out one of these shallow gas pockets that you would tap out if you drilled a water well, for example. And we can get 40% of the way we need to by accepting the new availability of natural gas. And I think it makes just good sense to do it.
That's Lawrence Cathols from Cornell University. But even with the reduction in U.S. carbon emissions in recent years, is it enough to slow down climate change? And are the potential environmental costs of fracking worth it? On that question, says David Victor, a fossil fuel expert at UC San Diego, the jury is still out.
While there's been a big reduction in U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide because of this shift to natural gas, it hasn't led to the kind of reductions that you need to stop global warming, which is a 50% to 80% reduction. So natural gas, at best, is a bridge to some kind of future where we have even lower emissions. But it's better to have a bridge than nothing.
This gas revolution, you have also argued, is not all roses. We're talking about some potentially serious consequences.
Yeah, I think we need to watch out for the environmental side effects of the gas revolution. There have been some wells that have led to small earthquakes. I'm frankly much more concerned about the local water pollution from fracking operations. And if the best practices aren't used in the well, then some of that water could leak into the groundwater, be spilled on the surface, and so on. There are air pollution concerns associated with fracking as well, and so we need to find ways to address those. And I guess it's important to underscore that we don't right now know whether shale gas itself produces other kinds of emissions. So some people are worried that the process of fracking and producing gas and moving it around the country might cause leakage of methane. So that could offset some or maybe all of the benefits of natural gas. I think the best science in this area doesn't find that to be a big problem, but we need to keep monitoring natural gas production methods to make sure that we aren't accidentally making the problem worse by shifting to fracking and natural gas.
Does it also take our eye off renewables? I mean, if we're so focused on cheap natural gas, what does it mean for wind power, for solar power?
Well, I think the initial impact for wind and solar, wind much more than solar, because wind is the largest share of renewable energy and is the part of renewable energy that's most competitive right now. The biggest impact on wind is to make wind less competitive, because wind is now competing against alternative sources of electricity that are much less expensive than they were a decade ago. I think the wind industry needs to also learn how to compete toe-to-toe with its rivals without federal subsidies and without mandates. And so I suspect that over the long haul, this is going to result in a renewable power industry that's more competitive, and that's good news. It's one thing to spend a lot of money on supporting renewable energy as a new technology, but now that it's scaling up, that technology has to grow up as well and be able to compete. Cheap natural gas is a formidable competitor, and I hope it leads to a more competitive wind and solar industry.
That's UCSD's David Victor. For now, natural gas is on a rapid ascent. Last month, for the first time in U.S. history, gas generated as much electricity as coal, now one-third of all our power. To another story now about terrorism, but this one about who owns information to the past, specifically a past that is still unresolved. Last week in Boston, the First Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a British government request to get transcripts of secret interviews with former paramilitary members of the Irish Republican Army. Those transcripts are held under lock and key at Boston College, part of an oral history project that a journalist named Ed Maloney started in 2001.
The idea was to build up an archive that would provide a unique insight into the minds of people who took part in this huge, in terms of Irish history, huge, momentous conflict.
Several dozen former IRA militants and also militants who carried out terror attacks for the pro-British Ulster Volunteer Force have been interviewed for the Boston College Project. Now, none of the interviews were authorized by the IRA, and only one person involved in the project knows the identities of those who did cooperate.
The IRA is a very controlling organization. It has very strict rules about disclosure of information.
So in order to get those former militants to talk, some of whom may have carried out terrorist attacks that are still unresolved today, they were granted confidentiality. Their interviews would not be released until long after they were dead.
So it was fairly unconditional in that respect. You know, I don't think we would have participated in the project, and I certainly know that the interviewees would not have participated in the project on any other basis.
Boston College was meant to be the guarantor. The problem, Boston College may not have that right.
And the court ruled that universities don't get to decide whether crimes are investigated. Government authorities do.
This is Sean Pogachnik. For more than a quarter century, he's covered Ireland for the Associated Press. And the crime he's talking about is a potentially explosive story, a 1972 murder that potentially involves some of the most important Northern Irish political figures, including Gerry Adams, the longtime leader of the nationalist party Sinn Féin. The murder victim was Jean McConville, a widow and mother of 10 children who lived in a rough West Belfast housing project.
By all accounts, she was an ordinary Belfast housewife. Rumors were circulated that she was perhaps a British Army spy and had a transmitter in her house, and she was secretly spying on the IRA members in her community in her midst. Whether there's any truth to that, we'll never know. But that's the IRA story, and so one day an IRA unit came by and made her disappear.
That year, 1972, the IRA intensified its anti-British terror campaign.
Bombs began going off in Belfast only about 2 hours after the IRA announced the end of the ceasefire.
1972 was the very worst year of the entire past four decades of conflict. There were 470 people killed in Northern Ireland that year, and you have to keep in mind this was a country at the time of barely 1.5 million people.
Jean McConville was one of at least 19 people in Northern Ireland who simply disappeared without a trace. It would take more than 25 years for the IRA to admit responsibility for her death, and in 2003, McConville's remains were finally located on a beach in Eastern Ireland. The post-mortem revealed a gunshot wound to her head. Jean McConville was executed. Now, nobody has ever been prosecuted for her murder, and that's where the Boston College Oral History Project comes in. One of the people involved in McConville's murder may have been a woman named Dolores Price, and it's widely believed that Price gave a confidential interview for the Boston College Project.
Now, Dolores Price is, again, part of a legendary IRA unit.
Again, AP reporter Sean Pogacnik.
She was one of the members of the first car bombing team that went to London and bombed the Old Bailey Courthouse and Scotland Yard headquarters and a few other locations. She's also a heavy critic of the current Sinn Féin peace strategy.
And for that reason, Price is also a critic of Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. Now, it's believed that the account she gave, the account now under lock and key at Boston College, will reveal that she may have driven Jean McConville to her executioners, and most explosively, that the order in 1972 was given by none other than Gerry Adams. Now, while most historians say Adams was indeed a senior commander in the IRA, Adams has always denied it and says he was never involved in paramilitary activity.
He laughs it off. He shrugs it off. He has a wonderful Teflon quality about all these things. And the fact is, when you have been a senior figure in the Provisional IRA, or really any sophisticated paramilitary group in Northern Ireland, nothing can be proven because you never got your hands dirty. If you're Al Capone, the only way they'll get you is on not paying your taxes.
Now, these allegations are not new. In 2010, Ed Maloney, the reporter who co-founded the Oral History Project, now housed at Boston College, wrote a book called Voices from the Grave. That book was based on another interview given to Boston College, the testimony of a notorious ex-paramilitary figure named Brendan Hughes. After Hughes died, Maloney published his account of what happened to Jean McConville. Irish television was given his video testimony and turned it into a documentary.
A special squad was brought on the operation there called the Unknowns. You know, when anyone needed to be taken away, they'd normally done it. I had no control over this squad. Gerry had control over this particular squad.
Hughes pointed the finger at Gerry Adams. Again, here's reporter Ed Maloney.
He was the Belfast commander at the time, so the buck stopped on his desk, as they say. The unit that took her across the border, along with other people who were disappeared, was his creation and reported directly to him.
But while Ed Maloney believes Adams was involved in McConville's murder, he also believes that the accounts under Boston College's protection should remain confidential, and that the commitment made to those who gave interviews should be honored. Boston College, though, sees it somewhat differently. Here's Jack Dunn, a spokesman for the college.
Mr. Maloney was completely aware when he conceived this project that there were limitations to the confidentiality to the extent of American law.
A bilateral agreement between the U.S. and British governments compels both sides to help the other in solving crimes. And the First Circuit Court of Appeals has interpreted that agreement to apply to this case.
The big issue is how this material, if it is handed over to British authorities, will it be published? Will it go on the public record?
Now, while the oral history testimony may not be enough to implicate Gerry Adams for Jean McConville's murder, the publication of that testimony could have huge political ramifications in Northern Northern Ireland, where a unity government of both Protestants and Catholics is still shaky. And Ed Maloney believes it could undermine the decisions Gerry Adams took in the past two decades.
So here you have the guy who brought the IRA into the peace process, who made all sorts of huge ideological compromises with the British government, being dragged into the court on the basis of information provided by the same British government. What does that say to members of his own organization and other organizations who have doubts about the whole peace process? It says basically, Gerry, you did a deal with the British, and now they've turned around and they've kicked you in the rear end.
The story is still evolving. Ed Maloney is still fighting to keep the Oral History Project out of the British government's hands. For now, those secrets remain at Boston College, and by the time a final decision is taken, it could be many, many years. By then, most of the people involved may be long gone anyway. Coronado Beach in San Diego was ranked America's best beach this year by the coastal researcher Stephen Leatherman, a.k.a. Dr. Beach. Waikiki and Hawaii and Hatteras and North Carolina make the cut this year as well. All great vacation spots for a little time away this summer, unless you're writer Andrew Blackwell, who decided to take his vacation at the dirtiest, most polluted spots on Earth. An oil pit in Canada, a city in India with open sewers, and the most famous one, Chernobyl, site of the world's worst nuclear accident. He wrote about these places in his new book. It's called Visit Sunny Chernobyl. And in those places, he found surprising beauty.
The world thinks of Chernobyl as a place where humankind had overwhelmed and destroyed nature. The phrase dead zone still gets tossed around. But this was nowhere more obviously untrue than here, watching the sunset, my entire horizon, a quiet rhapsody of water, sun, and trees. Paradoxically, perversely, the accident may actually have been good for this environment.
Good for the environment, well, that's up for debate. But in Chernobyl, Andrew Blackwell discovered that with an absence of human civilization, nature has simply retaken the place.
You come into Chernobyl, and because it's a quarantined radioactive zone, everyone has left a long time ago, and very few people spend any time there. And so you've got to go in spring, obviously, and it's just full of trees and birds and insects, and it's sort of become this huge accidental wilderness preserve.
Nature's taken over.
Yeah, exactly.
Retaken over.
It really has become, in a lot of ways, very parallel to a national park or nature preserve, although
the Chernobyl National Nature Reserve.
I really think they should make it a World Heritage Site. There's nothing like it, and it's an absolutely unique place, and most of it is just flat-out beautiful. I really defy anyone to walk through Chernobyl on a sunny day and say that it's not a beautiful place.
Were you wearing a protective suit?
No, no. I did buy a track suit. you know, in case the real question is if you're going to get contaminated. There's no protecting really against being irradiated, at least when it comes to gamma rays. But the question is, are you going to get nuclear material on you, worked into your hair or your clothes, and you don't want to track that away.
At a certain point, your guide, Dennis, says don't step on the moss. You're walking through this thick forest to get a glimpse of the actual reactor.
And that's one fascinating thing about Chernobyl, is that the moss, the mushrooms, even the trees have absorbed the radioactive particles into them. And so it's not just a place that has been contaminated with radiation or radioactive particles on it. They are sort of in it, which is another thing that makes it so incredibly fascinating, is that sort of the ecosystem itself has incorporated that pollution.
This book, of course, hops around the world to the world's most polluted places. A lot of places you visited seem obvious in the developing world, India and China. But you also visited one of the world's most polluted places here, right here in North America, Alberta, Canada.
That's where the oil sands industry is focused, in northern Alberta.
This is where they found this huge deposit of tar sands, and this is related to the Keystone Pipeline that we've been hearing a lot about, trying to figure out a way to get that oil to the U.S. and markets around the world. You say that the town, Fort McMurray, that it actually smells like oil.
Yeah, downtown, not always, but as soon as you sort of point yourself towards the mines, which are about a half-hour drive up the road, it starts to smell like tar, really, because that's what it is. It's a giant deposit of sludgy, tarry sand. It's called bitumen sand. And, you know, there's no way to dig that out of the ground without it just smelling like that everywhere. And, in fact, there are places along the river where naturally, deposits of oil sand have been exposed, and you can even smell it there, even if it's not being dug up.
It's a huge tar pit. But in this sort of idyllic setting, right? I mean, you've got pine trees and this beautiful sort of Canadian landscape, and then this huge facility, these tar sands, and then there's this amazing lake, Crane Lake, that you write about right there.
Yeah, well, Crane Lake isn't even the most amazing lake. Crane Lake is a sort of rehabilitated pond that the oil sand companies like to show off to convince people that they can kind of put nature back once they're done tearing it up. The real lakes that are most interesting there are the tailings ponds, which are sort of giant lakes of wastewater that is used in the extraction process when they're upgrading the sand and sort of getting the oil out of the sand. So it's these huge poison lakes. And every once in a while, a flock of ducks lands on one of these lakes and dies just by virtue of having landed there in this poison water. And that's sort of a running controversy in Canada. Ducks are sort of the poster children for what the cost of oil sands are.
I'm speaking with Andrew Blackwell. He's written a new book. It's called Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places. You are an environmentalist. You call yourself an environmentalist. But you also have some problems with environmental activists that you come across in some of these places. Why is that?
I think that even if we care about the environment, it's very important to be absolutely hardcore about finding out what is true. And I think there's often a temptation when you're an activist to spin things always in your direction. And I sympathize with that urge, but my belief is that we really have to be as absolutely skeptical and rigorous of things, whether or not they serve our own beliefs and politics, because that will make our beliefs stronger if they've, you know, stood the test of science and so on. And I describe this as a love letter to the world's most polluted places, not because I love pollution, but because I think by using these places as horror stories, we've kind of chosen to disengage from them. And I think that sense of only what is beautiful counts as a pure or clean environment, that can be a force for disengagement and for ignoring places that really need to be embraced in some ways. And so that's why I thought I'm going to go to polluted places and find what's still natural, what's still beautiful, what's still worth caring about, because there will always be something after we've ruined a place. There's still a place there. There's still some kind of nature. There's still an environment, even if it's not what we wish it would be.
That's Andrew Blackwell. His new book is called Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy.
All summer long, we've been asking actors, writers, and directors about the films that they could watch over and over again a million times, including this one from an Academy Award winner.
Hi, I'm Mira Sorvino. I'm an actress, and the movie I've seen a million times is On the Waterfront, directed by Elia Kazan, starring Marlon Brando, Carl Malden, Eva Marie Saint, and Rod Steiger. That was my first introduction to Brando. So that was kind of a revelation for me.
Listen, down here, it's every man for himself. He's keeping alive.
He's toying with the audience a little bit. He's toying with the camera. He's very much aware that he is all that, and he's kind of giving you this rakish charm, which it's a delight to watch because he's just so good and because he's so charismatic.
You don't remember me, do you?
Remember you the first moment I saw you?
Right in the nose, huh?
I think I wanted to be like Eva Marie Saint. I think I wanted to look like her. I think I wanted to be kissed like he kissed her.
Petey, you love me. I want you
didn't say I didn't love you. I said stay away from me.
I want you to say
stay away from me.
In the beginning of the film, we're introduced to Terry Molloy, who's Brando's character, who's this former boxer. And he's calling up to a windowsill. He's got a pigeon in his hand. And he's telling this boy, Joey, that he found one of his pigeons.
Yeah, he flew into my coop. You want him?
And what we find out is that this local mobster, Johnny Friendly, has his henchmen up on the roof. And Terry Molloy, Brando, thinks that they're just going to rough the kid up because he was going to talk to the Waterfront Crime Commission and maybe rat out Johnny Friendly's illegal tactics with the longshoremen. but actually they throw him off the roof. And this sets up the entire film, which is about the conflict between the abuses to the longshoremen who work the docks, which are being visited upon them by the mob, run by Johnny Friendly, and Brando's brother, played by Rod Steiger.
Before we get the
listen to me, Terry.
Take the job. Just take it. No questions. Take it.
That scene in the car, you know, the guy could have been somebody.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
I'm getting chills just thinking about it right now because it's such a powerful scene.
Instead of a bum, which is what I am, let's face it.
When Rod Steiger's character lets him out of the car, he's basically signing his own death warrant. But it's just an amazing moment. You know, I think all of us in life are constantly, you know, at different points in our lives confronted with situations where we have to make choices which define us. And, you know, that you have to remain a morally upstanding person, otherwise what do you have?
You hear that? I'm glad what I done.
My favorite scene, I don't know, I think the ending is so incredibly powerful. Like he gets beaten terribly and sort of left for dead on the docks, but then he has to take this walk because basically the, you know, all the dock workers say they'll only go to work if Terry goes.
How about Terry?
He don't work, we don't work. Work! He can't even walk!
And so he's half dead, but he has to take this stumbling walk up from where the mob's office is back onto the dock and into the warehouse. And it's just this incredible walk of, you know, man's struggle to resist and to fight back, you know, against the powers that be.
Me on my feet. Come on.
It's just so heroic that I think it's hard to beat that.
That's actress Mira Sorvino talking about the movie that she could watch a million times on the waterfront. Her new film, Union Square, opened in theaters this weekend. The new Batman film, The Dark Knight Rises, is probably the most anticipated movie of the summer.
There's a storm coming.
You sound like you're looking forward to it.
I'm adaptable.
It's the last film in the Batman trilogy that writer-director Christopher Nolan has crafted over the past 7 years.
You don't owe these people anymore. You've given them everything.
Not everything. Not yet.
Christopher Nolan wanted The Dark Knight Rises to feel like an historical epic, to have the feel of films like Metropolis, Dr. Zhivago, and Blade Runner. When he first tackled the Batman character almost a decade ago, Nolan was a controversial choice. He was better known as an art house film director, but since childhood, Christopher Nolan dreamed of reinterpreting this iconic character, a superhero who isn't one-dimensional.
For me, the character of Batman is the most human and relatable of superheroes. He doesn't have superpowers. Base level, he's just a guy who likes to do a lot of push-ups. He's a self-created hero. You know, this is a character who suffers terrible trauma as a child. He sees his parents gunned down in front of him. And really all three of these films, the whole trilogy has been following that attempt of that character to try and do something positive with this terrible thing that's happened to him.
The Dark Knight Rises picks up 8 years after The Dark Knight. That's when we last saw Batman, and he was taking the fall for the murder of the DA, Harvey Dent. So essentially the Dent's image as a hero would remain intact.
You either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. I can do those things because I'm not a hero. Not like Dent. I killed those people. That's what I can be.
No, no, you can't. You're not.
I'm whatever Gotham needs me to be.
Give us a sense of how we first encountered Bruce Wayne in this film and what we're about to see.
We were really adamant about continuing the story of The Dark Knight, not delivering, you know, just another episode in a series of Batman films or something like that. We really wanted to craft a conclusion to our trilogy, and so the consequences of what the protagonists do at the end of The Dark Knight were very important. It was important to follow that through and really sit there and go, okay, what would that lead to? And so immediately you say, okay, there's got to be a period of time we have to be seeing a Gotham where at least superficially Batman's not needed. Because the sacrifice that Gordon helps him make at the end of The Dark Knight has to mean something. So for it to mean something, it has to have worked on some level. So we're finding a Bruce Wayne who's living in self-imposed isolation for 8 years. He's locked himself up and, you know, a wing of Wayne Manor, very much in the manner of Howard Hughes in his sort of Las Vegas period.
And for for quite a while. I was wondering whether he would actually make an appearance in the movie.
Yeah, we really took the approach with this film of saying, we're not going to worry structurally about ticking boxes. We're not going to worry about pushing the audience's buttons at the appropriate moments in terms of their expectations of a genre film. And that's why it does take a while for Batman to return.
Do you think he's coming back?
I don't know.
When you look at the relationship between Bruce Wayne and his public face, the public face of this playboy Bruce Wayne, and then his other alter ego, which is this very dark monster, this Batman creature that he's created. Essentially, when he puts on the Batsuit, that is an action that has to have meaning. So you can't just sort of sit there and go, okay, we've seen enough of Bruce Wayne, now we want to see Batman. When he puts on that Batsuit, it has to be appropriate to the story. It has to be an action that he's taking for a particular reason. And so we tried to be really true to that and trust that we've earned enough interest from the audience in continuing the story that they'll be patient with us and they'll bide their time and follow the logic of the story as we really want them to.
This is a character that is owned by millions of people around the world. They have an idea of what Batman should be. Mm. How much does that weigh on you when you think about how to portray him and how to tell his story?
Batman belongs to all of us. He's been around for 70 plus years and he's very firmly burned into the popular imagination. So when you take on a character like that, it comes with a huge sense of responsibility. The way I fulfill my responsibility is to very sincerely make the best attempt I can to make the best possible film I know how to make and not worry about the film that somebody else would make.
Christopher, I have seen the film already and I'm sworn to secrecy, but I will say this. It was an anxiety-filled experience. My heart was racing, you know, throughout much of those 2.5 hours.
Well, I'm not sure we'd want to put that quote on the poster. Anxiety-filled 2 hours and 45 minutes. But the film is intended to put people on edge in exactly the fashion you describe, whereby you sit there and you can't take anything for granted, you can't take any characters for granted, you just don't know what's going to happen. And so there's a degree of fear that's present and never really goes away for the entire film.
I'm speaking with the writer and director Christopher Nolan. His latest film in his Batman series, The Dark Knight Rises, will be in theaters later this week. I want to ask you about the villain in this film. His name is Bane. He's played by the actor Tom Hardy.
When Gotham is ashes, you have my permission to die.
He was actually in a previous Batman film, Batman and Robin, directed by Joel Schumacher, but he was almost kind of a forgettable kind of henchman. In this film, he is incredibly terrifying and powerful, but he's also complex and highly intelligent. How did you think about constructing Bane in that way and turning him into that?
Well, to be honest, the character of Bane as presented in the comics is a fantastic character, and he is extremely intelligent and articulate and represents almost a flip side of Bruce Wayne, somebody Bruce Wayne might have become in a parallel universe or something. And that hadn't been presented in the films before. And then, of course, what Tom Hardy brings to the character is a total commitment. There's nothing tongue-in-cheek. Nothing is sold out to, I'm playing a comic book villain.
Why didn't you just kill me? Your punishment must be more severe.
And there are moments where you genuinely hate him, the way you would hate somebody in the real world who was doing such appalling things. And I think that's actually a very rare achievement in action movies, you know, to see an antagonist that you genuinely hate.
What's amazing about your background is that you actually started making films with Super 8 when you were a kid, 7, I read, and with your sort of Action Man figures, and then you came up with the idea for Inception when you were 16. You knew you were going to do this your whole life?
I think from a pretty young age. I mean, I started making films, as you said, when I was about 7. And I remember when I was about 12 or 13, sort of figuring out that there was a job of being a director and that that was the closest thing in terms of people involved with making films to what I'd been doing in just making my own little Super 8 films and so forth. And then I think the films of Ridley Scott, particularly Alien and Blade Runner, watching those films and realizing that even though the stories were different, the actors were different, something was connecting these films. The same mind was behind them. And realizing that, oh, that's this guy, Ridley Scott, he's the director. He's getting to to really define those movies. And so I think that really inspired me to want to specifically be a director.
Christopher, you have said that The Dark Knight Rises is going to be your last Batman film, at least as a director.
Yeah.
You have lived in this world for almost a decade now in Gotham.
Yeah.
What are you going to miss about him the most and telling his story?
The thing I'm going to miss the most about the great privilege of working with these characters is the built-in connection they have with the audience. That lets you tell a story in this incredibly heightened fashion, what I call this operatic style. And I will miss that enormously because you can't do that with characters that you make up. You can't assume that investment on the part of the audience. And so it's a different type of filmmaking, and that I will miss.
That's writer-director Christopher Nolan. His new film, The Dark Knight Rises, will be released this Friday, July 20th. Christopher Nolan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Chia.
Chia Pets, the pottery that grows.
They're fun.
Oh, Chia Pets, those terracotta figures that grow hair-like sprouts may actually help you live longer. Not the pets, per se, but the seeds you use to grow the sprouts. In recent years, chia seeds have become popular with runners and other athletes to help boost endurance. The seeds are rich in fiber, protein, and omega-3s. Wayne Coates, a foremost expert on chia seeds at the University of Arizona, has a new book out. It's called Chia, The Complete Guide to the Ultimate Superfood. In his free time, Wayne Coates goes on 100-mile runs, and he says during those runs, he often pours chia seeds from a film canister right into his mouth. He says chia seeds have long been a well-kept secret among runners.
An example is the Tahamara Indians of the Copper Canyon of Mexico. They've been known as the running Indians, and they have used it for years. The Aztec warriors used to carry it on their campaigns, and it is said that that's really what they ate. It gave them sustained energy.
The seed is native to southern Mexico and Guatemala. It was a staple for the Aztecs. So why was it forgotten as a food source for so long? Well, Coates blames the Spanish invasion 500 years ago.
The Spanish, of course, never heard of it, didn't know what it was, and they pushed the natives to produce foods that they were familiar with. We also believe part of it was to do with their religious ceremonies, because their main ceremony of the Aztecs would turn out to be just at the same time as Easter. And they actually made statues out of the chia flower and used it like a communion. So the friars were kind of horrified about this, and it was just pushed aside.
Fast forward to the early 1990s. Coates, who is also an agricultural engineer, was looking for a profitable crop to grow in Argentina. He found that chia was easy to grow, and he became convinced of its potential as a health food. And it's been taking off in the U.S. Over the past 3 years, at least 100 chia products have hit the market.
Add it to anything. I mean, some of our customers put it on their ice cream. We put it on our salad. I put it in my orange juice. You can put it in your yogurt. I like crunchy peanut butter sandwiches. Sprinkle it on, you have a little more crunch.
And for more on the chia phenomenon and recipes, check out our website, npr.org. And if you're just tuning in, this is Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's not often you get to start a business story quite like this. But the rock band Def Leppard is at the center of a business dispute with Universal, the company that owns the rights to their original recordings. Now, if you want to download Def Leppard's music from iTunes, you can't. It's not available because Universal and Def Leppard haven't been able to agree on how the band would be compensated. And we're talking about some huge hits here. You're listening to Rock of Ages from their multi-platinum 1983 album Pyromania. Universal owns this recording. So Def Leppard has been re-recording forgeries of their own songs to replace the originals. And here's how the new version sounds. Joe Elliott is the lead singer of Def Leppard, and he's in our New York bureau. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
First of all, help me understand the dispute. Why can't I download your original songs off, you know, of iTunes, for example?
Well, when we signed our record contracts, Noah was still sailing the Ark off into foreign climes, you know. It was 79, and there was no such thing as digital. It wasn't written into the deal, and consequently, They can only release them digitally with our permission, because that's written into our contract.
Right.
So one thing about having a great lawyer. And until we can resolve this dispute, we shall just keep doing re-records. And, you know, we want to wrestle back our career. That's I think anybody's been around as long as we have, you need to be in charge of what you're doing. You know, you should own as much as you can possibly own.
You guys are going to re-record your entire back catalog, I understand.
Well, that's about 180 songs.
Okay.
There are some strange Japanese B-sides that really aren't worth the effort. What we're trying to attempt to do, and it's down to the listener to decide whether we achieve it or not, is give them something that they, because it sounds like the original to me, is what people we want people to say. We don't want them to say it's better. We don't want them to say it's worse. We want them to say it's the same. I've gone on iTunes and I've looked for a certain song, and I've accidentally bought the re-record, and it's been awful. You know, it's just been lousily quickly done for a quick buck. We're not trying to make a quick buck. We're actually trying to maintain some kind of dignity in this.
All right, let's listen, Joe, to one of the re-recorded songs. First, let's hear the original. This is one of your classics, one of your biggest hits of all time, Pour Some Sugar on Me. And this was the original from 1987. Okay, so that's from 1987. Let's hear the new version re-recorded just a few months ago. Joe, that is, I'm serious, that is amazing. That, I mean, you, this sounds exactly the same.
Well, it was a lot of hard work. Thank you for noticing.
I mean, you. I mean, forgive
we studied
me. You,
are, them.
You sound great. But, I mean, you are not in your early 20s like you were.
No,
you know,
I'm 52, back. 52. Actually, I was 28. I think when I recorded that. The thing is, imagine a Picasso or something, and you know, somebody down the road buys this Picasso for $20 million, and then they find out it's not a real one.
Yeah,
that's what we're trying to achieve here. You know, it's like that. Whoever did the fake painting studied the original inch by inch, and we had to, second by second, go back and listen to that thing and go, okay, how does that bit go? So when we're at home, and we've all got home studios, it's very simple to just nip down a stairs to your studio for a few hours a week and just piece together something like that.
How did you capture your sound, your 28-year-old sound? What did you have to do something?
Yeah, you do. It's a headspace. It's like acting. I dare say that people like Pee Wee Herman don't actually talk like that in real life.
Right.
You know, they
right.
put on an accent. There are ways of doing it. You know, you just shape your mouth in a certain way. You train your brain to try and remember how you were singing back in those days. And you know, you don't always just do it in one take. I mean, you can, you know, you maybe just do a verse or listen back to it and go, I nearly got that bit right, and then you just work on it, and you just, it's like going through a history book is what it is.
Okay, so now that you've re-recorded your old songs, your classic songs, you own these new recordings. They are yours to do what you
absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely, we can license them, we can box them, we can sell them, we can sit on them. But they're ours, you know. I thought it was pretty sad when McCartney tried to buy his back catalogue and he got usurped by his ex-friend Michael Jackson. I didn't think that was a very clever move. And I also didn't think it was very fair. You know, it's fair enough we all sign a deal with the devil when we sign to some corporate label when we're teenagers and stuff. But as you learn as you go along and you realise that you're the ones that put all the hard work in, and yet you only get paid maybe the same amount you would tip a waiter for delivering room service, it's not right. So we're trying to do something about it.
That's Joe Elliott, the frontman for the band Def Leppard. They're in the process of re-recording their back catalog. They're also on tour with Poison and Lita Ford this summer. Joe Elliott, thanks so much. Good luck on the tour.
Hey, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
For the week ending July 15th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Brent Bachman. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amy Held, and Beenish Ahmed. Michael Tomsic is our intern. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in. Got the feeling.